Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Wednesday, the 20th of October, 2010, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 53 of Reality Check. And our first ever podcast-only edition. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality, and we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week, we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific, and finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to fill in some of the gaps from previous Reality Check episodes and talk about some of the points that were left on the cutting room floor when I was preparing episodes on UFOs, psychics, and vitamins. And we'll also hear a little bit of listener feedback from the last few weeks. Then in our movie review, we'll have a look at two new movies, one from China, Detective D and the Mystery of the Phantom Flame, and one from Spain, Buried. All that and more coming up on today's episode of Reality Check. Now, just before we get into our LGBT news roundup, I should mention that this is our first ever podcast-only edition of Reality Check. Since July 2009, Reality Check has been a weekly radio show on Joy 94.9. But for the months of October, November, and December, we're taking a rest from the broadcasting schedule and will just be produced as a podcast coming out every few weeks. Basically, whenever I get some spare time to write a script for an episode. Okay, now, here's our LGBT news roundup for the last 3 weeks, because that's how long it's been since the last episode of Reality Check back on September 27th. So quite a lot has happened since then, but I'll try to cover it all very briefly. And I'll try to advance through the news items in roughly chronological order. So first up, let's start with a couple of news items from here in Australia. And the first is that on September 29th, the Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young once again introduced a bill into the Senate to legalise same-sex marriage in Australia. Now, the Greens have done this a few times before, most recently last year, but each time the bill has been voted down by the major parties. This time, though, the situation is a bit different as the Greens now have a lot more power in the Parliament, and from July next year will hold the balance of power in the Senate. They are calling on the major parties to allow a conscience vote on the bill, but unfortunately the Prime Minister Julia Gillard has stated not only that she opposes the bill, but that she won't allow Labor MPs a conscience vote. Let's just hope she can be persuaded to change her mind over the coming months. Meanwhile, in a brief follow-up to a news item we reported on a few weeks ago here on Reality Check, the bill to recognise in Tasmania same-sex marriages performed in other jurisdictions was passed unopposed by the Tasmanian upper house on September 29th and will now become law. This makes Tasmania the first jurisdiction in Australia to recognise same-sex marriages from other countries, and they'll be recognised as the equivalent of registered partnerships under the state's already existing registration scheme. So, well done to the Tasmanians, a very positive development there. Okay, from Australia, let's head halfway around the globe now to Russia, where the possibility for advances in LGBT rights improved slightly on September 28th, when Russia's president, Dmitry Medvedev, ousted the mayor of Moscow, Yuri Luzhkov. His ousting had nothing to do with LGBT rights issues, but Yuri Luzhkov, who had been the mayor of Moscow for 18 long years, was extremely homophobic and had consistently banned any gay pride march or other LGBT events over the last few years, calling such events satanic. There is some hope now that the new acting mayor, Vladimir Rezin, will be slightly less homophobic and will, for the first time, allow an LGBT pride march to take place in Moscow next year. Fingers crossed. Meanwhile, he has already allowed two LGBT rights-related protests to take place over the last few weeks, so hopefully that's a positive sign for the future. And just a few days after Luzhkov was fired, October the 6th saw another positive development in Russia when a court in St. Petersburg found that the decision to ban the St. Petersburg Gay Pride March in June was illegal and violated the right to freedom of assembly of LGBT people. This is the first time ever in Russia that a court has upheld this right for LGBT people. So fantastic news there. And together these two stories provide small glimmers of hope for the future of LGBT rights in the world's largest country. And in breaking news just to hand, I've just learnt that tomorrow, October 21st, the European Court of Human Rights will finally hand down its ruling on the group of cases dealing with all the bans on gay pride parades in Russia over the last few years. So hopefully that will be a blistering decision in favour of freedom of assembly for LGBT people in Russia. Whatever the court decides, we will of course let you know the outcome in the next episode of Reality Check. Okay, let's stay in Eastern Europe now, but head south to Belgrade in Serbia, where the Belgrade LGBT Pride March took place on Sunday, October 10th. Serbia's first Pride parade took place in 2001, but ended abruptly when the participants were attacked by right-wing hooligans and skinheads while the police looked on. The organisers hadn't been able to hold another Pride March since then until this year. Now, here on Reality Check, we've been covering pretty much all of the LGBT Pride parades and attempted Pride parades that have been taking place in Eastern Europe throughout this year's Northern Hemisphere summer. Some have gone off peacefully, some have met with violence. But it seems they saved the most explosive Pride parade till last, because the Belgrade Pride parade last week sparked more violence than any other Pride parade this year. The good news, though, is that the Pride March itself went ahead peacefully, and none of the 1,000 participants was hurt, because they were protected by massive security barricades and over 5,000 police officers. The bad news, however, is that outside those barricades, it was pandemonium, with riots breaking out across the city as thousands of right-wing homophobic hooligans threw firebombs, bricks, rocks and bottles and tried to destroy pretty much everything in sight. The rioters chanted death to homosexuals as they burnt cars, hijacked a bus, broke windows, looted shops, and set fire to the ruling Democratic Party's headquarters, as well as attacking and damaging other political parties' offices, the state television building, and several embassies. It was chaos and senseless violence on a massive scale. Police responded with tear gas and rubber bullets, and at the end of the day, over 130 police officers and 25 civilians had been injured, some severely, and almost 250 rioters had been arrested. So, was the Belgrade Pride March a success? Well, yes, in the sense that the police genuinely did a very good job and protected the marches from all those vicious hooligans. Although success is hardly a word that can be used for an event that resulted in such widespread, pointless destruction and injury. It should also be mentioned that Serbia is very keen to join the European Union, hopefully by 2014, and so wants to portray itself as a defender of human rights, including the right of LGBT people to freedom of assembly. And I guess they did manage to successfully do that. Let's just hope that next year it won't come at such a high cost. Okay, let's cross the Atlantic now from the old world to the new world, specifically to the United States, where there has been a major and dramatic development in the battle to get rid of the hated "don't ask, don't tell" policy that excludes same-sex attracted people from the US military. As we reported a few weeks ago here on Reality Check, a federal court judge in Los Angeles ruled on September 9th that "Don't Ask, Don't Tell" was unconstitutional and should therefore be struck down. Her decision was not put into effect immediately, though. However, all that changed last Tuesday, October 12th, when she finally issued a worldwide injunction prohibiting the military from enforcing the "don't ask, don't tell" policy and ordering them to halt any discharge proceedings that had been commenced under that policy. And just yesterday, Tuesday, October 19th, she issued another order reaffirming that decision and rejecting a request by the Justice Department to lift the injunction. So, an incredible turn of events there, and really an incredible victory for LGBT rights. So all this means that as of last week, the "don't ask, don't tell" policy is now legally dead. It's unenforceable. Just like that. And in the light of this new reality, the US Defense Department yesterday instructed its recruiters, for the first time ever, to start accepting applications from openly gay, lesbian, and bisexual enlistees. We are indeed living through historic times, dear listener. Now, as for whether the situation will remain this way, well, no one knows. The US Department of Justice has appealed the original decision, and that appeal will presumably be heard in the coming months. It's all very ironic, though, because President Obama says he wants to see "Don't Ask, Don't Tell" repealed and gone. But he also says that he wants to wait for the Pentagon's report, which is due out on December 1st, which will outline the best way to repeal the policy. So who knows what will happen now? The policy's gone for the moment, but do Obama and the Justice Department really want to fight to resurrect it through the courts just to then fight to repeal it in a few months' time? it's all getting very messy for Obama just days ahead of the midterm elections on November 2nd. But whatever happens, dear listener, we will, of course, keep you informed of every development right here on Reality Check. And staying in the United States a little bit longer, I should also briefly mention the suicides of LGBT teenagers that suddenly became a major news issue in the United States, and one that is gaining attention around the world. The issue came to prominence following a series of suicides throughout September and October of gay teenagers, some as young as 13, which finally drew national attention to this ongoing issue. And I guess, as tragic as these incidents are, it is a positive development that suddenly society at large is becoming aware of the issue and of the very real and tragic consequences of homophobia. I hope that this will cause some people to question their own homophobia and maybe decide to stop making flippant, offhand homophobic remarks which they thought had no consequence. Hopefully those people will see that homophobia actually does have consequences, sometimes extremely tragic consequences, and it is an evil that everyone should be striving to eliminate from the societies in which they live. Now, for our final news item today, let's stay in the New World, but head south to the Caribbean to cover an issue of particular interest to geography buffs like me. Now, I don't know if you noticed, but a few days ago, the world lost a country but gained two new ones. Yes, dear listener, I hate to be the one to break it to you, but the country formerly known as the Netherlands Antilles, or the Dutch Antilles, ceased to exist on Sunday, October 10th. The Netherlands Antilles was made up of five Caribbean islands: Curaçao and Bonaire, just off the coast of Venezuela, and St. Eustatius, Saba, and St. Martin, close to Puerto Rico. But what happened on Sunday was that this country was dissolved, and Curaçao and St. Martin became two new autonomous countries, although still constitutionally within the Kingdom of the Netherlands. The three smaller islands left over, Bonaire, Saba, and St. Eustatius, have now fused with the Netherlands and have the status of special municipalities. Now, this is all very interesting, I know, but why are we talking about this in our LGBT news roundup? Well, the reason is this. The Netherlands was the first country in the world to introduce same-sex marriage back in 2001. That law didn't apply in the Netherlands Antilles, though, because it was an independent country. However, now that those three islands, Bonaire, Saba, and St. Eustatius, have legally become part of the Netherlands itself, Dutch law will apply there, including same-sex marriage and same-sex adoption. And just a few weeks ago, in September, the lower house of the Dutch parliament passed a bill to extend full same-sex marriage and adoption rights to those three islands starting from 2012. So unless any surprises happened before then, all that means that those islands will be the first in the Caribbean to have same-sex marriage and adoption rights. And that will be yet another positive step in the spread of LGBT equality throughout the Americas. Of course, the combined population of those three islands is only 20,000, so it's not going to affect a huge number of people. But still, it will be significant because those islands are largely very socially conservative and quite homophobic, as is the entire Caribbean region in general. So hopefully this new law will shake things up a bit when it comes into force in 2 years' time. Okay, that's all our LGBT news for today. There was quite a lot of news today because it was 3 weeks worth, but we managed to get through it all in the end. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up some loose ends from some previous episodes of Reality Check, dealing with UFOs, psychics, and vitamins. So don't go away. Much more Reality Check coming up.
Made in Melbourne for the world. Joy 94.9.
Hey, this is Corey Monteith from Glee, and you're listening to Australia's gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
We now move into the part of the show where we undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. And tonight I'm going to do pretty much a repeat of what we did in our special 50th episode, broadcast back on September 13th. And that unfortunately was never made available as a podcast because the computer that normally records everything that goes to air on Joy 94.9 was malfunctioning that night. And so now that I'm doing these podcast-only editions of Reality Check, and you, our beloved podcast listeners, missed out on that episode, well, I thought I'd cover most of the same ground we covered in that show, so that you're not going to miss out after all. So what I basically did in that episode was just touch on a few points that I'd had to exclude from previous episodes of Reality Check due to time constraints. Because several times I found, after writing the script for an episode of Reality Check, that it was too long and that the show would go over an hour. So often, shortly before going to air, I would have to remove several paragraphs to bring the show down to a reasonable length of time. So what I'm going to do on tonight's show is basically discuss some of those points that had previously been left on the cutting room floor. In particular, some points related to UFOs, psychics, and vitamins. And then, when I finish doing that, I want to read you a couple of emails from our listeners. So, without further ado, let's get on with the show, and let's start with one of everybody's favorite skeptical topics, UFOs. And the point I want to make about UFOs is that there are a couple of factors that would seem to indicate very strongly that UFOs are a cultural phenomenon, like witches or vampires or something, rather than a real phenomenon. So the first factor that would seem to indicate this is the fact that pretty much all the seminal UFO cases that form the basis of almost all the UFO folklore, well, all of them come from the United States, which would really be an amazing coincidence if we were talking here about a real phenomenon, but is not so surprising if what we're witnessing here is a cultural phenomenon that originates in the culture of the United States and is then exported so successfully around the world, just like many other aspects of US culture. So, in the episode where we outlined the basic history of UFO folklore and how it's developed over the last 70 years or so, we mentioned pretty much all the classic seminal incidents that sparked interest in UFOs or came to be regarded as milestones in the development of the UFO mythology. And those incidents all took place in Washington State, New Hampshire, Arizona, New Mexico, etc., etc., all states of the United States. So what an amazing coincidence, especially when you consider that the United States covers only 6.4% of all the land on the earth. Incredible, isn't it? What are the chances that each time they visit, the aliens always seem to land in that same 6.4% of the Earth? Really quite astonishing, isn't it? Of course, I know that UFO incidents are reported in other countries, including here in Australia, but they all seem to be just variations of the original archetypes which came out of the United States. For example, the first flying saucers were reported in the United States and then spread around the world. The first alien abduction cases occurred in the US and then spread. The whole Roswell mythology comes from the United States, the Men in Black, the conspiracy theories, etc., etc. The paradigm is set in the US and then is taken up to varying degrees in other parts of the world. It's also interesting to note the pattern in which that UFO culture has spread around the world. Basically, reports of UFOs are most frequent in countries that are culturally very similar to the United States and dominated by US culture, such as the UK or Australia. While at the same time, you never hear too many reports of UFOs from places more culturally distinct from the United States, like, I don't know, India, Iran, or Indonesia. This is, of course, exactly how you would expect a cultural and social phenomenon to spread, but not a real phenomenon. Now, the second factor that suggests that what we're seeing here is a purely cultural phenomenon is the fact that UFO sightings really only began at the time when human beings themselves were starting to fly. The whole UFO phenomenon basically began in the 1940s, when people were starting to fly in ever greater numbers and aviation was really starting to take off, so to speak. So, what a coincidence that even though the Earth has existed for about 4.5 billion years and Homo sapiens sapiens has existed for about 150,000 years, and historical records go back about 4,000 years, the extraterrestrials finally started visiting Earth just at the moment when human beings discovered the technology to fly themselves. Another amazing coincidence. So, an incredible double coincidence there. The UFOs arrive just as humans are starting to use aeroplanes, and they always seem to arrive in the United States. Really extraordinary coincidences, aren't they? Unless, of course, this could all be explained as a culturally specific mythology that reflects what's going on in certain particular cultures on the Earth at certain particular points in time. Probably the more likely explanation for UFOs, don't you think? Okay, let's move from UFOs now to another staple of the skeptic's diet, psychics. And here I want to refer back to the episode in which I discussed the technique known as cold reading. This is a technique to make it look as if you have psychic powers when you actually don't. And in that episode, I mentioned that so-called psychics are very good at sizing you up and looking for clues about the type of person you are from your appearance and general demeanor, and also often go fishing for information with innocent-sounding questions. Now, what I left out of that episode and what I want to mention tonight is that probably the most important factor in understanding how a psychic works is not so much the way that they go fishing for clues and information so they can try to get hits instead of misses. The real trick to being a good psychic is just plowing on and turning misses into hits, often just through sheer force of will. If you want to be a good psychic, it's all about your attitude, your demeanor, the confidence that you exude that says you're always right, and that allows you to make every miss seem like a hit without blinking an eyelid. Now, there was a very good interview a few months ago on the podcast Point of Inquiry, an interview with Ian Rowland, who wrote a book called The Full Facts Book of Cold Reading. And he really stresses this point. He says the real trick for the psychic is not trying to get hits and avoid misses. Of course, that's nice, but that's not really that important, because it's really about making everything into a hit. And the good psychics will do this without skipping a beat and without even flinching. And you can see this strategy in action with the very slick professional psychics like Uri Geller, Sylvia Brown, and John Edward. Even if John Edward, for example, is totally wrong with one of his guesses, he'll recover instantly and then he'll turn it against you somehow and make it seem like it's somehow your fault or that you don't understand something properly. He'll insist that he's right. For example, a psychic will ask, "Any stomach problems recently?" "No." "Nothing in the last few months?" "No." "So your stomach is completely fine?" "Yes." "Are you sure?" "Yes." "No abdominal cramping, bloating, gas, discomfort of any kind?" "No." "Are you sure?" "Yes." Well, you know what? I'd suggest going to see a doctor to have it checked out, just to be sure. So even after a string of clear, unequivocal misses, the clever psychic manages to find a way to wiggle out and even makes it look as if he's doing you a favor. Yes, dear listener, they're deceiving you, manipulating you, fleecing you of your hard-earned cash, and making it look at the same time as if they're doing you a favor. Frankly, I don't know how these people can look at themselves in the mirror. Okay, enough about psychics. Let's move on now to vitamins. And here I just wanted to recount to you a personal anecdote about the potential dangers of too many vitamins. So back in January, we did an episode on the misleading way in which vitamins are marketed. They're pitched not just as something that we all need in certain quantities, like oxygen or water or other basic necessities of life. They're marketed as if they'll somehow make you extra healthy and extra alert, as if they can perk you up and fight off disease and boost your immune system, whatever that means, and even treat illness. Of course, vitamins can't do any of that. They're essential for living, but that's all. Like oxygen, or, I don't know, like chlorine, for example. You need chlorine to live. It's an essential element. But you never see people selling bottles of chlorine water to give you extra, I don't know, extra brain power or something. It just doesn't sound very sexy. Neither does boron water or molybdenum water. But those are essential elements too. Yet for some reason, the word vitamin does sound sexy to the gullible public. Yet because vitamins are so sexy and such a cool marketing gimmick, so many products these days come with added vitamins. And the problem is, if you have too many products with added vitamins, you can quickly start to end up ingesting excessive levels of vitamins. And that brings me to the story that I want to tell today. Because I used to take a multivitamin and mineral supplement every day. And I also used to constantly get nasty pimples on my chest. One would erupt and last a week or so, and then just as it was disappearing, another one would start to erupt. Sometimes they would get a bit infected and become a lovely festering boil. Anyway, this went on for years and I never thought much about it. But in 2005, when I was living in Mexico, I went to see a dermatologist for a completely unrelated issue. But when she saw the pimples on my chest, she asked if I took a multivitamin. I said that I did, and she said, "Stop taking the multivitamin and see what happens. I think those pimples are caused by an excess of B vitamins." So I stopped taking the multivitamin, and guess what, dear listener? I haven't had a pimple on my chest since then. I've also done a bit of research since then and discovered that one known side effect of excessive vitamin B6 and B12 is indeed pimples on the body. And when I say I haven't had a pimple on my chest since 2005, well, that was true until a few weeks ago when one of those horrible pimples came back, just like in the old days. So I wondered what could have caused it. And then I remembered I'd just started taking an iron supplement, because I'm a vegetarian and last time I had my iron levels tested, they were getting quite low. So I carefully read the label on the bottle of the iron supplement that I'd bought, and sure enough, I read that it was not just iron, but iron plus, and came with, you guessed it, added vitamin B6 and B12. Needless to say, I was rather annoyed with this and have stopped taking that iron supplement. And my pimples have gone away once again. Anyway, why did I tell you this story? Well, just because this whole experience brought home to me in a very direct way that excessive levels of vitamins can have nasty effects on your body. In a way, I think I was lucky that the effect in my case was visible on my skin. It makes me wonder what some other effects might be that are internal in the body's organs and not visible. It brought home to me that for someone who lives in the developed world and has a balanced diet, having extra vitamins added to everything you eat is not really a good thing. Nor is it always just a harmless and benign thing either. People can quickly get into a situation where they're taking toxic levels of vitamins without even realizing it. And this can have harmful and unpleasant side effects. The whole thing has made me much more wary of any foods with added vitamins. Okay, now for the last part of the skeptical segment of the show, there are a couple of emails from listeners that I'd like to read out. The first comes from a long-time listener, Rue in Canberra, who is also Reality Check's official Icelandic pronunciation coach. And Rue wrote in relation to our discussion of the federal election back in August, when I enunciated my amazing marginal seat principle, that the only thing that a party has to do to get power and stay in power is focus on winning the marginal seats. Rue says, and I quote, "Loved your marginal seat principle as discussed on Reality Check. I was actually thinking a very similar thing the other day during the election campaign. Perhaps two independent moments of shared intellectual genius, a bit like Darwin and Wallace. I was also thinking, after the election, that it is now clear to me, especially after hearing the refreshingly unguarded and non-bullshit approach to answering questions that all these independents seem to have, that the main issue with the major political parties is that their policy development is too influenced, even dictated by, vested interests and financial supporters. Broadly, Labour influenced by the unions and the coalition influenced by business. And of course, the opinion polls in the marginal seats. and not by principles, which is why they always seem to be having to talk around issues when questioned by the media. So a lot of the time they have to provide answers that are obviously wrong on principle, but it is the party line they must follow. The only party that is not beholden to this situation is the Greens. They don't care if their principles and policies mean they don't win government. They believe in them anyway and instead go about trying to argue positively for them and convince others of their validity, not trying to massage them to fit the requirements to win the marginal seats and satisfy their backers. End quote. So thanks, Roo, for your interesting observations there on our imperfect political system we have here in Australia. And finally, I'd like to read another nice email, this time from a listener here in Melbourne, Mark. Now, it was quite a long email, but I'll read just a couple of paragraphs so you get the gist. Mark says, and I quote, "I'm a straight married guy who has recently discovered your show, and I just wanted to say that I find it great listening. When I first heard your program, I didn't know it was Reality Check, but then I caught the second half of your show about the Raelians and was inspired enough to seek out the podcast. I've just listened to your episode on naturopathy and found it to be awesome. I consider myself to be dedicated to the skeptic cause and am well versed in the craptapulousness of many things, e.g. homeopathy. Inevitable, really, as a follower of P.Z. Meyer's equally awesome Pharyngula blog. But realized I had a bit of a blind spot when it came to naturopathy. Your show filled that blind spot very nicely indeed. Thank you. If it's not obvious from my reference to P.Z. Meyer's, well, yes, I am an atheist. And it occurred to me after I started listening to your show that I think the atheist and LGBT communities probably have a lot to offer each other in terms of support and common goals. You may be aware many atheists consider our position as not so dissimilar from where the LGBT community was 50 years ago in trying to raise awareness of the inequity and inequality of their situation and working to make it socially acceptable to be LGBT. Your ally, Mark." End quote. So, a couple of great emails there. Thanks, Roo, and thanks, Mark. And thanks to everyone else who's written in to Reality Check. Please keep the emails coming. We always love to hear from you, our beloved listeners. And a few listeners have written in with suggestions for topics for future episodes of Reality Check. For example, Teresa here in Melbourne and Melissa in New York. I haven't forgotten you and I still will try to get around to those topics in the coming months. Meanwhile, if you'd like to send in your own email, the address is realitychecktony@gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage too for past episodes of Reality Check. That's at realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's take a short break and then we'll get into this week's movie reviews.
And then there was Joy. And then there was Joy. Joy, 94.9.
Hey, this is Leah Michelle from Glee and you're listening to Australia's gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman. And for the next few months, we'll be available as a podcast only, but one that you can listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. It's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the two movies up for review tonight are Detective D and the Mystery of the Phantom Flame and Buried. Let's start with Detective D. This is the latest epic blockbuster from legendary Hong Kong director Choi Hark, who previously made many of the films in such hugely successful movie franchises as Once Upon a Time in China, A Better Tomorrow, and A Chinese Ghost Story. And with Detective D and the Mystery of the Phantom Flame, he's planning to launch a new blockbuster franchise revolving around the figure of Detective D, a kind of ancient Chinese version of Sherlock Holmes. The film is set in the year 690 AD, during the lead-up to the coronation of the Empress Wu, the only empress ever to rule China in her own right. As the film opens, there is much opposition to her accession to the throne, and all kinds of conspiracies are being hatched to prevent her from taking power. Then, when some of her high court officials begin to spontaneously combust, literally, most people believe this is some kind of curse or divine intervention, and the Empress brings in Detective D to work out what's going on. He begins an investigation into these mysterious deaths and soon finds himself the target of assassination attempts as he moves ever closer to resolving the mystery of the Phantom Flame. Now, this movie, I have to say, is a pretty enjoyable romp, and it's certainly spectacular to look at. There's a lot of money up there on the screen to produce some amazing special effects. If you enjoyed films like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, The House of the Flying Daggers, or Hero, you'll probably enjoy Detective D. Now, I'm not crazy about martial arts fighting scenes, and there are a few of those to get through, but the fast-moving twisty plot was enough to prevent my attention from lagging. And there are some pretty original scenes in the movie, too, that added an element of surprise. Killer reindeer, for example. So I found this movie fun and pretty exciting, especially as the tension builds towards the climax at the end. Having said that, though, there was one thing that really frustrated me about this film, and that was that I couldn't really follow all the details of the plot because of the dreadful subtitles. They were obviously not written by a native English speaker and used a strange, stilted form of English and bizarre terminology that made it really hard to work out what was going on. Also, some of the characters seemed to be referred to by two or three different names, so it was hard to work out who they were talking about. Now, maybe the story would be easier for a Chinese audience to understand because they're already familiar with the character of Detective D and the mythology surrounding him. But still, that just makes it more important to have good, clear subtitles for audiences unfamiliar with the story that have to get up to speed with the context as well as follow the convoluted plot. Presumably, the print of this movie just arrived from Hong Kong with subtitles already in place, and it would have been uneconomical for the distributors to get a whole new set of subtitles prepared. But still, it's really annoying when your enjoyment of a film is spoiled by poorly written subtitles. One final positive point to note about this movie, though, is that Detective D, like Sherlock Holmes, is actually a great role model for skeptics. When everyone around him is jumping to the conclusion that ghosts or gods or monsters were responsible for particular disasters that have befallen them, Detective D tries to come up with explanations based on the natural material world, and always manages to discover the complicated reality behind what appear to be supernatural events. A bit like Scooby-Doo, actually. So I'm happy to say that Detective D and the Mystery of the Phantom Flame is not only a fun movie, but also one that promotes skepticism. A good combination. Our second movie up for review this evening is Buried, a Spanish-Australian co-production filmed in Spain by a Spanish director and starring a big Hollywood star from Canada, Ryan Reynolds. Buried tells the story of Paul Conroy, played by Ryan Reynolds, a US contractor working in Iraq, who wakes up to find himself buried alive inside a wooden coffin with only a cigarette lighter, a torch, and a mobile phone. Why is he there? How did he get there? And does he have any chance of getting out? Well, these are questions I'll leave you to find out, dear listener, when you see the film. What I can say about Buried is that it certainly is a unique premise. All the action for the entire 90 minutes of the film takes place inside the coffin. The camera never leaves the confines of that box. There are no flashbacks and no cuts to what's happening in the world outside. We are stuck there in the coffin with Ryan Reynolds for 90 minutes. So coming up with an engaging and interesting film within these parameters must have been a really huge challenge for the scriptwriter and director. And I have to say, they largely managed to pull it off. I was gripped for pretty much the entire length of the film. And I actually found myself more affected by feelings of claustrophobia than I thought I would be. The film is very tense and really quite grim the whole way through. My only complaint is that at times I did find the story a little bit contrived and even sometimes quite cliched. But overall, I think the filmmakers have come up with a pretty gripping and engaging movie, especially given the tight parameters they set for themselves. And that brings us to the end of the 53rd episode of Reality Check. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com. And visit our website to subscribe to the podcast at realitycheckonline.net. Have a great week, everyone, and I'll be back with episode 54 sometime in the coming weeks.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.